Welcome to David Maister's Business Masterclass, a series of advanced business seminars exploring principles and practices for success in professional businesses.
Hello, I'm David Maister. In this week's seminar, entitled Justifying the Company, I'll explore how companies and firms can make sure that they are more than just the sum of their parts, more than just a federation of people or business units sharing office space or ownership. This can be true at the small firms, or at the other end of the size scale, the same question becomes, how do we ensure that national or regional firms are something more than just a set of country practices only operating under a common name? Earlier in this podcast series, I argued that the best way to develop strategy was from the bottom up, allowing each operating unit to develop an action plan to compete in its marketplace. Even in a tiny firm, I argued, it's still my view that you should work upwards, starting with each person's personal strategic plan, and then aggregate in order to develop the larger unit's plans. The scale may be different, but the process and the order is the same. Work upwards. However, this approach raises some interesting questions. If each and every decentralized operating unit has to design, develop, and execute its own strategic plan to win and serve its own customers and clients, what then is the role of the company itself? For example, if you are in one of these sub-businesses, does it matter which overall company your unit belongs to? Could you just uproot your group and go join another firm without noticing the difference? Is a company or a firm inevitably nothing more than a collection of businesses? Or can there be value in the company in itself? Should there be? And again, notice that these questions apply at any level of aggregation. They could apply to a tiny firm that has two small departments offering different services, or the same questions could apply to a local firm with a few separate offices, or even a global mega firm with different country operations or different industry teams. In every one of these situations, the challenge exists to make sure that the company or firm is more than just the sum of its parts. There are a number of possible answers, including the following traditional alternatives. First, there are things that could be shared across boundaries, justifying all the separate units belonging to the same network or firm. For example, there could be techniques for disseminating and sharing knowledge, skills, and experiences. There could be shared investments in tools, methodologies, templates, research. There could be rapid, timely access to the skills of others to help with current assignments. There could be joint, shared procedures to produce well-trained employees. Of course, the familiar one, there could be a high level of referrals cross-selling each other. And finally, there could be the benefits of spreading the benefits and savings of fixed cost items, like support staff and systems, including technology, to facilitate the conduct of the business. Now, in my observation, even though these ideas are very, very old, few companies are in fact good at sharing these things. Take, for example, the seemingly basic issue of trying to tap into the company's accumulated network-wide experience in order to perform better current and future work. Few companies have succeeded, in spite of great efforts, at building effective knowledge and skill sharing. The problem has not been one of a lack of tools or technology, but the lack of a culture which allows the firm to capitalize on these tools. In most businesses, the companies that could design an effective knowledge and experience sharing mechanism would indeed obtain a significant competitive advantage. As we have repeatedly noted in this seminar series, building a sharing culture is the key strategy. Investing in tools that remain unused is not strategy. A second way in which a company can add value is through a unique or special approach to management. If the company's top people are better at bringing out the best in the performance of the units, then management itself can be a major competitive advantage brought to the table by the company. There are two common versions of this. The first is that the company provides superior abilities in financial and control systems better than the subunits have. This rationale can be very real. and actually historically explains the growth of mega firms and holding companies and networks in such businesses as accounting and law and marketing communications. The acquiring entities, or those doing the roll-up as it is sometimes known, bring better financial management and create new value that the smaller firms historically could not seem to acquire. Note, however, that there's nothing about scale that prevents good financial controls and management. You don't absolutely need to be aggregated into larger companies to achieve it. You could do it yourself. The same is true of the second form of managerial added value, where top management of the company creates more value by knowing how to provide a supportive but challenging coaching environment to bring out the best in each unit, or how to collaborate a sharing environment. As we shall discuss again and again in this series, superior management is a great source of competitive advantage, so one must not dismiss this as a simple way that companies bring value to their subunits. Better management is a crucial strategy. Now, all of these concepts are familiar, but that doesn't make them common. It might be interesting to poll your separate units or groups, your businesses, and ask them how well they think your company, your network, is actually delivering on the potential benefits of belonging to the network, the company, or the overall alliance. As I described in my podcast series on managing professionals, it is often the case that the desired benefits of belonging to a group are more of an ambiguous wish list than a reality, and not every group would concede that the way they are being managed adds a lot of value. Unfortunately, many businesses are, in effect, federations of separate businesses or people trading under the same brand name. Few companies have been able to forge together their separate organizations to take advantage on a regular, systematic basis of their collective power. In other words, to form a truly connected network. Many are trying, but few are there yet. As we noted earlier, this is not just a problem of size. Mega firms can be very well connected, and small firms can also be nothing more than a pack of entrepreneurial hunters with no loyalty or connection to each other. It's not a matter of size, but of culture and management, of recognizing that how the company is integrated through management is a profound strategic choice. In many cases, I have come to believe that where we have not accomplished this, the only real justification for some companies and firms to exist is that the company allows each business unit to diversify its risk, that when some of us are up, others are down, and it washes out. This can be a very real benefit. However, even this is under attack in the modern world because inside many of these firms, reward systems are put in place which give rewards to performance with a very short-term feedback loop, in which case we don't actually diversify each other's risk at all. Let's take another perspective here, using a different lens to examine the way a company or network can add value. First, we could say the network is valuable by helping the individual business units perform its own task better. Call this the individual empowerment method because it aims to make each business unit more empowered to serve its own clients better because of membership in the network. Second, the network could be in value beyond individual empowerment by pursuing and serving multi-unit or collective clients and customers that no one business unit could pursue alone. Let's call this second type the collective action rationale. These two justifications for a network or a company or a firm to exist, individual empowerment and collective action, represent two completely different purposes or rationales for the network or for the firm, requiring significantly different management practices. I have a hypothesis that of the two, the most important strategy is to ensure that the network functions well in addressing the individual empowerment issue. Ensuring that first, each business unit is better able to win and serve its own clients because of its membership in the network. It's been my experience that if people are not first benefiting personally with their own business, they're not going to be as willing to cooperate with others in joint collective ventures, and we never get to the second benefit. Collective action can bring in glamorous, exciting, and more profitable work, but only if it works. First, you've got to ensure that the players are eager collaborators, and that's not easy. Collaboration depends on mutual trust, respect, and confidence. And the likelihood of success will be promoted if the individual unit has a history of deriving benefit from the network, interacting with other businesses for these purposes, and establishing prior relationships before they need to be drawn upon for the collective action. A second line of reasoning supports this conclusion. When companies do pursue collective action, they rapidly discover that clients require each unit of the team to be strong in its own right. You can't build a strong multi-unit team if there are weak players. Therefore, it is in the company or network interest to ensure that the network is first functioning well on the individual empowerment issue before attempting to tackle the collective action purpose. Let's turn to the issue of collective action between operating units, trying to win and serve bigger and better clients through joint activities. The first point to be made here is that, in my experience, every business has the strategy of one-stop shopping and cross-selling, trying to grow multidisciplinary or multi-location relationships. There are two problems with pulling this off. First, there are almost certainly more providers who want to sell integrated one-stop shopping than clients and customers who want to buy that way. Such customers exist, but not in proportion to the number of companies that have bet their strategic future on making this happen. Second, if companies are to win this one-stop shopping, integrated service, multiple service business, they must be able to deliver what the integrated service purchaser is primarily seeking: multi-unit coordination, control, and consistency. Yet this central benefit flies in the face of step one that we have been discussing. If you have spent most of your time making sure that the network serves the autonomous interests of its separate component units, then suddenly turning around and getting them to collaborate and give up their position as autonomous, distinct profit centers is in many firms a revolution of mentality. The two benefits from the network can be very, very different in their culture. Individual units usually have been used to controlling their own client and customer relationships. In the multi-unit strategy, there needs to be, for the client or customer's benefit, someone in charge across boundaries. Naturally, individual business units fear this loss of control and worry about being dictated to. In addition, they worry about profitability. Who is to negotiate the pricing for the multi-unit service? How will the revenues be allocated across the various businesses that are involved? Why should we spend time trying to obtain a multi-unit assignment when we incur all the marketing costs and only get some of the revenues? Note that these arguments and difficulties occur in all kinds of businesses. To take just one modern example, these cross-unit rivalries have destroyed many a grand strategy for product-based computer firms trying to develop service divisions. In another seminar in this podcast series, I address the issues of creating collaborative behavior. My goal here is simply to point out that these strategies are obvious but not easy. That's why they remain the source of competitive advantage. Before we finish, we should address one more topic: branding. Some people believe that the way a company adds value to its constituents' units is by conferring the power of a brand name. However, what is misunderstood about the value of brands is that they have value only to the extent that they represent a form of quality assurance to the buyer who can dependably rely on certain aspects of performance. Campbell's Soup, for example, has brand value, not because it's the best soup in the world necessarily, but because when I go to the supermarket, there is less perceived risk in buying Campbell's Soup than in choosing a no-name generic brand. It is the operational consistency, the dependability, that creates the branding premium. It's not enough if the buyer obtains great service or a great product by catching the right person in the right location on a good day. Brand value is created if and only if certain standards of performance are obtained every time the buyer uses the company. To a real extent, therefore, a company name, and hence a company, will have value to the extent that it has procedures to enforce its quality standards. You can't confer the benefits of a brand on a new acquisition or a new office or a new service unless you have first made sure that that new office or service or location truly does dependably and reliably live up to the operational excellence that is represented in your brand. Branding is a managerial operational concept, not a marketing one. The idea is obvious, but the diligent execution that would be required to make it a strategy is often beyond the capabilities of many multi-unit firms. This concludes Justifying the Company, the 8th episode in my 14-part series, Strategy in Professional Businesses. Upcoming seminars in this series will focus on creating an adaptive firm, how companies should add value, and how to think about mergers, geographic expansion, and diversification. Today's seminar was based upon materials in two of my books, Managing the Professional Service Firm and True Professionalism, details of which can be found on my website at davidmaister.com. This podcast series is now available for purchase, both as a single episode and as part of a DVD set, from my website, davidmaister.com/store, STORE. I'm also pleased to announce that my forthcoming book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker, is available for pre-order from this same location.